Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week we talk about precedents. John Burt of Brandeis University discusses his new book, Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism.
He had seen Lincoln as really the figure who was able to synthesize what each side had to say and also to purge away what was really the matter with what each side had to say.
Journalist Jeffrey Frank talks about the strange relationship between Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon.
I thought it was really time to go into it, to really go down deep into this really interesting relationship which had a narrative arc and which dealt with two figures who together were the whole 20th century.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field and Greg Coles has bestseller news. Well, we're living in a prolonged or extended Lincoln moment. There have been a number of important books, but the most remarkable of all may be one that's on our cover this week. It's called Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism, Lincoln, Douglas, and Moral Conflict. It's by John Burt, a professor of English at Brandeis, and it's reviewed for us by a political philosopher at Yale, Stephen Smith, who says that John Burt has written a work that every serious student of Lincoln will have to read. He has created or rediscovered the Lincoln who's very much for our time. I'm delighted that John Burt's here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thank you, Sam, and thank you for that very generous introduction.
John, let's talk a little bit about your history, because I know something about it. We sort of, many years ago, began doing the same thing. We were students of poetry, English literature. How did you find your way to Abraham Lincoln? What drew you to him?
My first book was about Robert Penn Warren. Warren was passionately interested in Lincoln as a Southerner who had had to come to terms with race and with slavery, since that was what Warren himself was. And he had written on and off, but piecemeal, extensively about Lincoln. When I read his book, The Legacy of the Civil War, which was a brief, rather philosophical treatment of what he thought were really separated the Union and the Confederacy philosophically, he had seen Lincoln as really the figure who was able to synthesize what each side had to say and also to purge away what was really the matter with what each side had to say.
Now, John, there is, it's kind of a classical work you've written. We have the great protagonist Lincoln. There's also a great antagonist, Stephen Douglas. And what do you think about him? Have you spent many years on this book? Where did you come out on him? Is this a major figure too?
Oh, yes. And that actually was the surprise. Douglas is almost never portrayed sympathetically. He's always seen as a politician on the make, a fixer, a ruthless agent in his own behalf.
And why? Why is that the view of him?
Well, because he was. I mean, there's a great deal of truth to that portrait of him, you know, in the same way that there's truth to the same kind of portrait about Johnson or about Martin Van Buren. I think that he found himself backed into a position where he discovered a kind of depth in himself that I don't think anybody else would have seen in him by the crisis of the long slide into civil war.
So let's paint the picture here. Mm-hmm. You write a great deal about the classic debates, mm-hmm. the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And very briefly, what's at stake here? What are the big issues they are in this remarkable way grappling with?
We inherited a model of how politics works from the Federalist Papers, which is about deal-making and compromise over interest issues. Now, that isn't to say that they imagined politics as wholly amoral, but they imagined themselves as fair-minded, worldly deal-makers.
So we mean Hamilton and Madison. We mean the great founders.
Yeah, Madison above all. Madison above all. And particularly in the 10th Federalist paper, Madison describes an ethos of fair-minded deal-making where you want to behave in such a way that you can preserve persuasive engagement with the other side. And that sometimes means you have to settle for half a loaf in hope of getting a little more later. You have to trade off issues that matter with you a little for issues that matter with you a lot. You have to accept defeat sometimes, but recognize that your opponent the implicit assumption is that your opponent is not going to ask of you anything that's going to require of you a fatal sacrifice of interest or value. Well, you would think that that kind of politics could handle issues of morality about as well as it could handle issues of interest, particularly if you are a modern cynical type who thinks of issues of morality as issues of interest in disguise. You know, that's a view that has a unearned reputation of being a superiorly realistic view. It turns out that that's a difficult art to master. If you tried in the, say, 20 years before the Civil War, between the Mexican War and the Civil War, to say, I am going to make this kind of moral concession to get this other large moral advantage that will play out in the long run for my side, you frequently wound up destroying your career. And you also wound up, even worse than that, inflaming the conflict you were hoping to settle.
So give us some particulars here. The great free soil debates, they're fighting over the territories. Will slavery expand? Lincoln gives a great speeches about this. So take us inside the arena where these two were debating.
Well, I think the key is we can look at the Compromise of 1850, which happened while Lincoln was out of politics. The major agent behind it was Douglas. The issue was, will California come into the Union as a free state? And will the territories that were taken from Mexico by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo be organized on a free territory or a slave territory basis? Well, California had a population that had strongly declared they wanted already to come in as a free state. The issue with that is that if they came in with a free state, the South would lose the balance of power in the Senate that they had lost long before in the House, and this scared them. So they demanded some kind of compensation for accepting the organization of California as a free state. What they got was the Fugitive Slave Act, which, as I said, wound up inflaming the crisis that it was intended to make a deal. Lincoln, by the way, accepted that bargain the same way that Daniel Webster did. But it was a bargain, as I said, that didn't settle the issue. It made the issue worse. Even more striking was the way the compromise had to be passed. When Henry Clay put it in one big bill that would mark it as a compromise, all it did was join the opponents of compromise on both sides. The northern anti-slavery Whigs and the southern pro-slavery Democrats joined on a series of, I think, shockingly opportunistic votes to destroy the compromise that was called the Omnibus Bill. It was called an omnibus because anything could get on it like an omnibus. When that happened and Clay went off to die, Stephen Douglas came in and he recognized that only about a quarter—
And Douglas was in the Senate at
Yeah,
this
Douglas
point.
Was senator from Illinois then and head of the Committee on Territories. And he realized that only about a quarter of Congress actually supported compromise. And the parts that supported compromise were the really desperate minority factions of both parties, the Northern Democrats like himself and Southern Whigs. The way he made the compromise was he separated all the elements of the compromise so that those that seemed South-favoring would get Southern Democrats and Northern Democrats and Southern Whigs, and those that seemed North-favoring would get Northern Whigs, Northern Democrats, and Southern Whigs. And between those, he cobbled together the Compromise of 1850. But the result was a compromise that almost nobody felt allegiance to as a compromise. It was one of those treaties that as soon as you make it, you're looking for reasons to blame the other side for things falling apart afterwards. And indeed, it was Douglas himself who kicked over the apple cart, again unintentionally, again making what he thought of as a prudent compromise to advance his side.
Douglas then has emerged this time as sort of a kind of accidental heir to Henry Clay. He's going to be the great compromiser.
Yes.
Now, Lincoln engages with him. Lincoln wants that Senate seat. Mm-hmm. At what point does slavery cease to be an issue just of bargaining? To appease all the sides, how did it become elevated to this great moral cause that Lincoln and Douglas now debated?
That's a very complicated issue because it happens for different people at different times. It was always a moral issue for abolitionists from the 1830s. It was always a moral issue for non-abolitionist opponents of slavery like Lincoln, who felt that they would be able to tolerate it where it existed already, but they didn't want complicity in spreading it because they felt that if they could confine it, it would ultimately lose its vitality.
Sometimes questions arise about Lincoln's view of race and slavery and preserving the Union and all the rest. But the argument was that if you could keep slavery just to those states, Then the number of free states would so far outnumber them, you could have eventually sort of abolish it, vote it out of existence.
Yeah, that was Lincoln's hope. And in entertaining that hope, he had an idealized picture of what Southern slaveholders were like, because his model slaveholder were people like Jefferson or Henry Clay, who had slaves but didn't really like slavery and looked about wishfully for some way to end it but didn't actually find any.
And so these debates are heating up. Now, Douglas is from Illinois. He's not from the Deep South yet. So why is he taking what would seem to the normal person, why is he defending slavery in these debates with Lincoln?
Well, Douglas is a Unionist, and Douglas is afraid that the Union will be destroyed over the debate. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Douglas is not certain which side is going to win if there's a war. And the third thing is he's not certain that even if his side wins the war, that it's not going to be transformed in a very ugly way by that victory. So he has reason to be scared of these things. He knows what happens to you when you get absolute right in your pocket and start clubbing people over the head with it.
Okay, now here's a question for you, John. What you're describing, the way you're describing Stephen A. Douglas, a contemporary American who's been following our politics would say, well, he sounds like the pragmatic one, but the title of your book is Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism. So tell us about Lincoln's pragmatism.
Okay. Lincoln's tragic pragmatism differs from Douglas one very essential point. There's a question about deal making, which is whether you have to be on the same page about certain central values, whether there are things that are beyond the pale for reasonable people to negotiate about or not, whether there are things you have to agree on or I can't deal with you at all. And for Lincoln, there are certain things that you have to buy if he's going to deal with you. And chief among them are the promises made in the opening sentences of the Declaration of Independence. If you don't believe those things, then Lincoln is not sure you're somebody whom you can cut a deal with, because he's not sure you're really capable of valuing democracy if you don't believe those things. He's not sure you're not ultimately going to seek some way to put non-slaveholding white people under the thumb to. For Douglas, he believes that if you specify these are absolutes that you have to have, that you have to sign on to, both sides have to sign on to, or it's no deal, he is aware that what happens in an actual argument once you do that is that each side grabs the absolute, then uses it to sharpen rather than to resolve the debate.
Which is what we see happen continually in our politics now.
Right. So Douglas was really only seeking a temporary modus vivendi that would enable us to skate very quickly over the thin ice and hope we would get somewhere later. You can see that in the way he got the Compromise of 1850 over. That wasn't a principled compromise. That was what he could get people to agree to. Douglas felt his job as a politician was to get people to postpone killing each other for a year. That's what compromise meant to him. But it didn't mean coming to an actual meeting of minds over deep issues. And I think the issue that's what separates Lincoln and Douglas. Lincoln is not the kind of idealist who's going to be clubbing people over the heads with their big ideas either. But there are different lines where Lincoln is going to draw the line. What's tragic about Lincoln's pragmatism is this. Lincoln is aware that we don't have a very clear idea of how our deepest values cash out in the here and now. We never understand them fully. We don't know what they've committed us to. When Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, he hated slavery, but he did not imagine the Declaration of Independence of its own force as ending slavery in America. And if he had said it that way, South Carolina and Georgia would not have gone in the Union. Part of Jefferson's hesitation was pragmatic hesitation. I can't force this issue or I foreclose any future. But also part of it is a genuine limitation of his own imagination, that he could not see his way clear to how the United States was going to live as a society where former slaves and their masters had to live together.
Well, and at that moment in history, very few could.
Indeed. In fairness to him. Likewise, Lincoln did not explicitly, except at the very end of his life, say that the final consequence of emancipation was going to be racially equal citizenship. And part of that is also strategic indirection. He couldn't say that or emancipation wouldn't have happened. But also part of it is that he had not himself fully grasped the meaning of his own promises. But the argument in my book is that he had committed himself to that as a consequence, whether he acknowledged itself or not, as early as 1858, not just at the time of the Emancipation Proclamation, but at the time of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. What's tragic about that pragmatism is that it says, we do not know how we're going to cash out our values. We don't fully understand them. We see them through a haze of illusion, self-love, wishful thinking. And only events clarify them in our minds. As Dr. Johnson famously said, nothing clarifies your mind like the prospect of being hung in the morning.
Right.
Even when we do act in the name of our values, we always do it in ways that are still complicit, still fraught, still a little bit unrealized, and leaves us unprepared to face the next obligation, which is going to unfold from a deeper grasp of what our values really mean.
John, let me ask you an entirely different question. You spent many, many years, I mean, 26 years on this
26
book?
26 years on this book.
I have Lincoln's collected works. It's a big set of volumes. How great a writer was Lincoln? You know, the great critic Edmund Wilson said, this is one of the inventors of the American style.
Oh, the music of his language is really unmatched. He is the greatest elegist, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, maybe the greatest elegist in English. The second inaugural in particular, but also the Gettysburg Address, although written in prose, they are the deepest poetic elegies I could imagine.
That's a kind of genius. And how good a writer was Douglas?
Well, Douglas did not have Lincoln's eloquence, and he also didn't have Lincoln's intelligence and his moral genius. He was tremendously vital and energetic. There are always pictures of him as he would speak getting hotter and hotter and taking off more and more clothes as if he was ready as he was speaking, as if he was getting ready to sort of settle it with his fist with his opponent. He's very, very energetic. He's very human. Even when he's fighting really dirty, and Lincoln and Douglas spend a lot of time fighting with each other in extremely dirty ways, there's always a sense that that he's playing. I know this because in his private letters about Lincoln, he's saying, oh, I'm going to have my hands full with him. He's the best guy they have. He's honest as the day is long. He's full of wit. He's full of intelligence. And he's also really good. So we know that he didn't really think any of the bad stuff he was saying about Lincoln in those debates.
And was he aware that Mary Todd certainly was. She chose Lincoln over Douglas. That Lincoln did have a finer mind. Did he ever defer to Lincoln?
Yes, actually, strange to say. The evidence for this is oblique. In the 1860 election, Douglas became persuaded that Lincoln was going to win. It was a four-candidate election. It was essentially two separate elections between Lincoln and Douglas in the North and between Bell and Breckinridge in the South, because the Democratic Party had split over the issue of slavery in Kansas. Douglas had said, if Kansas doesn't want slavery, they don't have to have it. And Breckinridge essentially wanted to force slavery into all of the Western territories against the will of their people. Douglas, after the collapse of the Democratic Party, they came apart at their convention, became persuaded that Lincoln was going to win. And he actually was the first presidential candidate to go out on the stump and campaign. But he didn't campaign for himself. He went out on the stump all over the South to say, when Lincoln wins, you do not have any grounds for secession, and secession would be foolish. You know, for all of his virulent racism and his extremely unfair tactics, it's hard for me to completely hate him, because that was a brave and upright thing for him to do. At the inauguration, you know, famously, Lincoln stood up to take the oath and then realized that he had forgotten to take off his hat. And Douglas stood up and took his hat from him and sat there with his hat in his hand. But even more important, there was an issue of what to do with the states that were already seceding. And there was a question of whether you want to take a relatively hard line, which Lincoln was taking, or a relatively soft line, which many Southern Whigs wanted to take and many Northern Democrats wanted to take. One very key thing that Douglas did during the first inaugural address is that he was very loudly interjecting things like, yes, good, that's right, throughout the whole first inaugural address, indicating that he was going to back Lincoln in the confrontation with the Confederacy.
So when he did that, that was something that was audible and visible. There's Douglas cheering Lincoln on, and the crowd sees that, and other politicians do too.
Yes, this is reported. Also, after Fort Sumter, Douglas was enraged by Fort Sumter because he had felt personally betrayed by the South, whom he had offered every possible persuasive consideration. And he essentially wore himself out and died, raising troops for the Union Army after after Fort Sumter. It's clear that Douglas was as unacceptable to the South by 1860 as Lincoln was, and they would have seceded had Douglas been elected president too. But it's not clear to me the Union would have won under Douglas because I think he was such a hothead he may have fought the war recklessly.
So there's a tragic element to Douglas as well.
There is. I don't think that he has the depth that Lincoln had, the intellectual depth that Lincoln has, but there is a tragic element to Douglas. That comes out very clearly in Johansson's biography.
Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
That's John Burt, whose new book, Lincoln's Tragic Pragmatism, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. So, Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes from the Field. Hey, Leslie.
Hello, Sam.
So the short story never disappeared. It's a treasured American form, but we're seeing just a huge volume of short story collections.
That's right. Well, first of all, at the top of the New York Times bestseller list, well, not at the very top, but leading the New York Times bestseller list, a short story collection, 10th of December by George Saunders. That's a fairly unusual occurrence, so right there you can make note. But what we're going to see in the next coming weeks, and we've seen some of this already, is many more short story collections coming out. And while the short story never went away, it was never publishing's favorite form.
They're pretty hard to sell. Now, there is Saunders, who is kind of a legend. Also, Jhumpa Lahiri has had successful collections. Junot Diaz. But it's rare. Who are some of the authors who've got short story collections coming out?
I want to say that one of the reasons I think we're having short story collections coming out, in fact, is Junot Diaz. His short story collection from last year, This Is How You Lose Her. Also, Nathan Englander's collection, both did very well and I think helped propel and give confidence to publishers to go towards authors doing short stories.
And in some cases, Leslie, these are quite established, accomplished novelists who are kind of going back to the form.
Right. So here's the really interesting thing. In general, short stories are for people who specialize in it, Cheevers, Saunders, Munroe, or for very new writers, Jhumpa Lahiri's first collection. It's a way to introduce someone. The basic idea used to be that once you became an established novelist, a short story collection was not what your publisher wanted to hear from you. But the dynamics of that has changed with the internet. And so we are seeing a surprising number of established novelists coming out with some stories. Here are some examples. In addition, of course, to 10th of December, he always does short stories. But you have Karen Russell doing Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Her last novel, Swamplandia, was nominated for the Pulitzer in 2011. Damage Control is the first collection by Amber Dermott. Her novel, The Starboard Sea, was a bestseller in 2012.
And was on our cover, a rare first novel on our cover.
Right. We Live in Water by Jess Walters, just off the best-selling Beautiful Runes. Now, Jess Walters is also on your cover, this time as a reviewer.
Does Tom Perata, the novelist, also have short stories?
Absolutely. I talked to him at great length. Here's a man who hasn't written a short story collection in more than a decade. And he has one coming out. He was, in fact, he said, inspired because he edited the best short stories of 2012. And seeing all the changes in the form that have happened made him inspired to finish his own collection.
You know, it's interesting, Leslie, because we think of America as the country that prizes and values bigness. But actually, the short story is a form that many of the great American writers pursued and perfected. Hemingway and Henry James and Fitzgerald and Faulkner all wrote short stories. Saul Bellow did too. So it's great to see this form getting a new life. And we have the sense that Saunders, George Saunders, is the beacon for some of these writers. Do you have that impression?
I have the impression that he's a beacon, but there are other people out there. People have mentioned Lydia Davis to me. Munroe to me is people who had her 30-year collection, I think, out last year as being very important. The other thing that people have mentioned to me that I thought was fairly interesting is the internet, that the short story is the perfect vehicle for the digital age. What it does well is it makes an intense connection in a short period of time. And if you're reading on a small screen, that's exactly what you're looking for.
Well, you know, it's a little bit like the way in popular music, the album has gone away And the single, the iTunes single, is taking its place.
Exactly. As we see things break down into their essential points, we're going to see more of this. And someone made a point to me, Tom Parada, that some of the big novels of last year, like The Goon Squad, could be interpreted as a series of short stories because they were from different perspectives, sometimes intimately linked, sometimes obscurely linked.
Thanks so much, Leslie.
Thank you.
This is Barry Gowen. I'm an editor at the New York Times Book Review. I'm speaking today to Jeffrey Frank, who's the author of the new book, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. You'll see the review on the cover of this Sunday's Book Review. Jeff, why don't we begin by your telling us just quickly what your background is?
Well, I've been a writer and an editor for basically as long as I can remember. My last job, I was a senior editor at the New Yorker magazine, and I also wrote for them. I was particularly proud of a piece I did of critic at large on Peter DeVries, and I was an editor and writer at the Washington Post. My last job for a little over 12 years. My last job there, I was the deputy editor of the Outlook section. And I'm a novelist. I've written four novels, and the last three, which we call the Washington Trilogy, comprised of books published between 2001 and 2007. And I also did a translation with my wife, Diana Kronefrank, who is Danish, and I speak Danish, so we translated. We did a new translation of the stories of Hans Christian Andersen.
That's something of an unusual background.
It makes it impossible to get grants from anyone.
let me ask you, there have been so many books on Nixon and a good number of books on Eisenhower as well. How did you come to choose this subject and write this book?
Well, in the first place, it's always fascinated me. But in the second, every book about Nixon or every book about Eisenhower deals with this relationship. There's always a chapter on it because it's unavoidable, particularly the famous episode, the famous fund crisis business. But no one ever just did this alone. And I thought it was really time to go into it, to really go down deep into this really interesting relationship, which had a narrative arc and which, you know, dealt with two figures who together were the whole 20th century. Eisenhower was born in 1890. Nixon died in 1994, and you had a whole story ending up as a family story at the end. So that's what did it. And I said, no one quite saw this as a great narrative. It's almost as a novel.
Our reviewer, Joe Scarborough, whom our listeners will know as the host of Morning Joe, was fascinated by the material you found on this incredibly complex relationship. And in his review, he suggests that Nixon comes off almost as a pathetic figure, constantly trying to gain the approval of this great war hero. Is that your view of Nixon? How has your own view of Nixon changed as a result of writing this book?
Well, I saw him more as a needy figure than more as a pathetic figure. He was a hard-working staff person in a big office trying to please his boss, always trying to please his boss and finding that his boss could never be pleased. He was a lieutenant. As he said, I felt like I was constantly going in to see the commanding officer. And Eisenhower was a five-star general. And we didn't have any five-star generals. We had four of them, and they're all gone now. And in fact, I valued that title so much that he kept it after he left office. It wasn't Mr. President. It was going to be general. And Nixon, but he was very needy. And he, and my view of him changed simply because I began to see him as a more rounded figure. He was a very complicated man. And all the view we have of him today is, you know, this evil guy who spouted all venomous things on his tapes and Lord knows what. But this is his presidency. He was in public life for 50 years before and after the presidency, from the time he ran for Congress in 1946, and then this pretty interesting post-presidency. And I began to see this very interesting, complicated man who had many good sides, particularly on issues like civil rights.
I think one of the great virtues of your book is that it does give this three-dimensional view of Richard Nixon, who, as you say, has come down in history, at least at this point in our history, as basically an evil figure. And here you have the human Nixon. Did anything surprise you in your research as you were doing it? Did you find yourself changing paths or changing your views?
Things that surprised me were making certain discoveries. There was one in particular that just absolutely fascinated me. Eisenhower had a stroke in 1957, which it turned out to be not that serious an illness, but for a short time, people didn't think he was going to make it as a president. He couldn't speak. There were the New York Post, which was no friend of Richard Nixon, suggested Eisenhower ought to resign and just better Nixon than no president at all. And all these things were going on behind the scenes then. Bill Rogers, who had become Attorney General, suddenly began a correspondence afterward with the Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, talking about what do you do if a president is incapacitated? How do you succeed them? And then I went to the Library of Congress and then found Frankfurter's response saying, you know, the framers very purposely left this out of the Constitution, figuring it could be done on a case-by-case basis. And at that time, it had only happened twice. When Garfield was shot, he lingered for a few weeks, and then Wilson's stroke. Dulles became obsessed by Wilson's stroke. What do we do? How do you who takes over in the event that the president can't function? And Eisenhower and Nixon actually talked about it too, and Ike set down a sort of set of guidelines about how it might happen. If Eisenhower thought he couldn't serve, he would turn it over to Nixon. If he thought he was ready to take the office back, he would tell him so. That didn't resolve everything, but at that time they thought it did, and it might have worked only because there was so much oversight around them from the cabinet and Congress. But my goodness, it was interesting, and now we have the 25th Amendment, which was just being born as an idea back then.
And finally, let me ask you what I think is an irresistible question when one reads your book, which is, how do you think of the Republican Party then and now? What do you see as the differences and the continuities?
I don't see almost no resemblance. The conservative wing of the Republican Party then was represented by Robert Taft, the senator from Ohio who wanted to run for president in 1952. And he was thought of as a conservative mostly because he was an isolationist. He wanted no part of the United Nations, and he really wasn't a big after the war. He said let's just get out of the world. Eisenhower, by contrast, was a big internationalist, and so was Richard Nixon, who even though he was considered a sort of right wing congressman, was a big supporter of the Marshall Plan. He toured Europe after the war and was pretty shocked by what he saw. They had slightly deranged people in the party then. There was a man named William Ezra Jenner of Indiana who thought sort of an invisible government was possibly running things. And then there was Joe McCarthy sort of going off at the edges with finding communists everywhere. But the party itself was a party that supported civil rights. It was a party, and say Taft himself was a big supporter of giving old age pensions to everyone over 65. This was a very different party. And then Richard Nixon, who had a reputation as a big red hunter, he was a big supporter of sort of federal health insurance, and for good reason. He had two brothers who died young, and there wasn't very good health care in Orange County in the 20s. And it was a very different party and a much more inclusive party. Nixon gave a speech at the Commonwealth Club once, and someone asked him, he said something, how would you feel if the parties were more aligned, left, you know, sort of the conservatives, the Republican and the Democrats were more liberal? And Nixon said that would be a great tragedy because then neither party would be able to govern the country as a whole party, representing all these sections and factions of the country. And that's what happened. The Republicans would be unable to govern in its right wing state, and the Democrats are governing okay, but you can see the fury that they're being greeted by the other side.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay.
This is Barry Guin talking to Jeffrey Frank, the author of an exciting new book called Ike and Dick: Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
On the fiction side of things, Gillian Flynn is back at number one with Gone Girl in its 36th week on the list.
Wow.
The new books are new at number four, Lisa Gardner's Touch and Go. It's a detective novel. Then down at number 12, J.A. Jantz also has a mystery new on the list. That's called Deadly Stakes. And the last new book on the fiction side of things this week is at number 15. It's by Melanie Benjamin, and it's called The Aviator's Wife. It's a historical novel about the marriage of Charles and Anne Morrow Lindbergh. Benjamin has made a bit of a specialty writing historical novels about kind of obscure women in history. Her two previous novels are Alice, I Have Been, about Alice Liddell, the model for Alice in Wonderland, and the autobiography of Mrs. Tom Thumb, about Mrs. Tom Thumb, Lavinia Warren Stratton. This book about Anne Morrow Lindbergh, Lindbergh is probably the most prominent person that she's written about.
Yeah, she's hardly obscure.
But Benjamin actually told Amazon.com in an interview that that made it maybe harder for her to capture her because she had less freedom to invent, but that Lindbergh, in fact, was a very private person and always happy to kind of hide behind the greater prominence of her husband, Charles. Lindbergh was herself an aviator, aviatrix, but never had the fame that Charles did. The one place where she did actually outshine Charles was on the bestseller page.
She was a very popular writer.
She had 9 New York Times bestsellers over the course of her life, compared with just 2 for Charles, including Gift from the Sea, which was on the list forever. It was at number 1 for an amazing 46 weeks back in 1955 and 1956.
She a good writer?
Of a certain kind, yeah. She wrote sort of reflective, self-helpish, kind of early feminist books, staking out a woman's interior life and saying it's important, almost like meditations. She also wrote novels. You know, she made and poetry. Some of her poetry made the bestseller list as well.
I think at one point she was extremely popular in women's magazines. She was kind of a real figure for American women.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. And of course, she had a very eventful and in many ways tragic life. So it's surprising if this is the first novel based on her to hit the bestseller list, because she's quite a dramatic figure.
And what about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side of things, there is a new book at number 10 that's called Beyond Belief. It is a memoir by Jenna Miskovich Hill, written with Lisa Pulitzer. And if you recognize that name Miskovich, she is the niece of David Miskovich, who leads the Church of Scientology these days. She left the church when she was 21 years old amid great conflict. She had fallen in love with somebody the church didn't want her to marry, and another Scientologist, but the church was opposed to the marriage. She, as a Miskovich, was being groomed for great things in the church and was part of the prestigious Sea Org wing of the church.
I know it's extremely hard to prove a negative, but is there any evidence that there's a single citizen of the United States who either was not at one point a Scientologist or is now? Is there anybody who's left who wasn't sucked into this thing?
It's funny you say that, because this is actually the second book about Scientology to be on the bestseller list right now. Lawrence Wright's Going Clear, which is a big expose about Scientology, is at number 5 in its 4th week on the list. So you kind of have to wonder if they're freaking out a little bit inside Scientology right now. These 2 books on the list together at the same time right now are actually the 3rd book in 2 years, because Janet Reitman, the Rolling Stone reporter, had a book called Inside Scientology that came out last year and got a lot of attention. So suddenly there's a lot of outside attention on this very insular cultish group right now. You have to think that maybe they're getting a little bit nervous.
To think that placid world, ripples of disruption.
And then finally, the second new title on the nonfiction side of things this week is An Introduction to Physics for the Amateur. It's called The Theoretical Minimum, written by a couple of guys, Leonard Susskind, who is a physics professor at Stanford University. He directs the Stanford Institute for Theoretical Physics. And a guy named George Hrabowski, he calls himself a citizen scientist. He never went on to get a PhD. He's not a professional physicist or scientist, but he heads a scientific institute out in the Midwest and is fairly prominent and active as a scientist. and especially bringing science to the amateur population. Susskind taught a continuing ed class through Stanford to kind of older non-scientists in the community and found that they were very hungry for hard physics, including the equations and everything. And the class became very popular, and he posted it on YouTube, where it just exploded. And Hrabovsky saw it there and contacted Susskind and said, hey, have you ever thought about turning this into a book? And that this book is the result of that, and it's at number 13 on the list this week.
So between the Scientologists and the scientists, we have the bestsellers covered. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.